Raised in poverty and dysfunction, lifted by football, education, and a desire to make the world a better place, Casey Gerald thought he had things figured out, his purpose, his path forward. But something changed his mind. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many people have described Casey Gerald as the personification of the American dream. He went to Yale on scholarship, later the Harvard Business School, and he's one of the founders of MBAs Across America. But he feels we need to take a good, hard look at the American dream and what it means. He's written about his life in the new memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. I'll talk with him about his experiences, what he's learned, and what he calls the gospel of doubt. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many people have described Casey Gerald as the personification of the American dream. He grew up in poverty in Dallas, Texas, but excelled in school and on the football field. He went to Yale on scholarship, later to Harvard Business School, and he's one of the founders of MBAs Across America. But Gerald believes we need to take a good, hard look at the American dream and what it means. He's written about his life and his journey in the new memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. Yesterday, he spoke in Iowa City as part of the Green Room, a University of Iowa honors course that has opened its doors and invited the city to school. This was the final event for the Green Room for 2018, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on. And Casey Gerald is here with me now. Hello, Casey.
Hi there, Charity. So good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I want to start where you start in telling your story. And you start your book this way, you start your TED Talk this way, with New Year's Eve, 1999. It was a moment when many people believed that the world would come to an end in one way or another. And you were part of a congregation that was anticipating the rapture at midnight on New Year's Eve. Why do you start your story there?
I started in part because it's a damn good story. I mean, it's hard to really convey to people who were not alive at that time or who were alive and did not believe either in the evangelical second coming as I did or the technological second coming as some other people did. It's hard to convey how transfixing and all-consuming that anxiety was of waiting for the world to end. So we gather in my church that evening for watch night service. And I had turned 12 that year, which meant, in my understanding, theological understanding, I was now accountable for all my sins. So I got baptized a second time, and I started reading the Bible, and I read these horrible Left Behind books. You know, I read some of them.
So right before the deadline.
Absolutely. I was trying to get it together. It was like cramming for an eternal test, you
right.
know. And we gather in the church, and we're packed in there, and the pastor says, it's 11:50, come down to the altar. We want to be praying when Jesus comes back, and we go down, and I'm waiting, I'm sweating. It's all hot, and he's praying hard. And then he finishes, and we look up, and we're still there. And I write in the book that I did not want the world to end. My world had already ended. My mother had disappeared. My father had fallen into addiction. You know, we were really hard times. I wanted to be rescued. And the rapture seemed an elegant solution. So why I start that with this book is that I think very similarly, the world that my generation inherited has ended. Yeah. The institutions, the promises that we were given have all failed or been compromised. And that's both a very traumatic experience for us, but we also, I think, are living through the early days of sort of a rebirth, reinvention, reimagination of the world that we need. And so much of what this book is trying to do is almost do an autopsy on that world that we were given and say, it's all right to let it go, y'all. And we don't have to wait for the second coming. We can get to work now.
When you were 12 years old and the rapture didn't come, it strikes me that that was a moment in your life when you really started questioning what was going on around you. Do you mark that as a time when you started really becoming a critical thinker and thinking, wait, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't add up.
I think the more honest view of 12-year-old me is that that was a marker of him being deathly afraid of uncertainty. My mother had started to disappear. My mother suffered from mental illness and bipolar, and she started disappearing for days at a time. And she was my best friend. I tell people my mother's kind of like a mix of Blanche DuBois from Streetcar Named Desire and the 1980s Whitney Houston. Yeah. And she was a very strange and brilliant, beautiful person. And she started disappearing. And I didn't know what to do. And so I got this idea that if I walked the sidewalk perfectly from my elementary school to my house, and I couldn't put 2 feet in each square, and I couldn't put a foot on the crack between the square, she'd be home when I got there. And it worked once. And so I got in my mind, if I can bring order to myself, perhaps I can bring order to the world. And so I write in the book that in the place of paradise, I had to find the kingdom of this world. I had to find some path of quote-unquote salvation, whether it was in school or conforming to a standard that perhaps might offer me in return some certainty. I didn't really want to think critically. I don't know very many people who, I mean, that takes a lot of energy. What I did want was certainty. I wanted to be sure of something.
So you needed a different path.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit. You've talked a little bit about your mom. Let's talk about your dad. And he had a storied past. He was an incredible football player. Tell me about him.
Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised I've had such a great time, and was raised a Buckeye fan, you know, so I just was anticipating great animosity as soon as I stepped in the state. But it's really great.
Good.
Yeah. You know, my father is still considered by a lot of people to be one of the greatest high school football players in the history of the state of Texas. He went off to Ohio State and played for Woody Hayes as quarterback. He was the second black quarterback in the history of the program. And he was Orange Bowl MVP against the University of Colorado in 1977. By the time I was born, the story that I got of Rod Gerald was that he had thrown his life away for drugs, you know, drug addiction. And that story held for a long time, and then I started writing this book.
And where did you get that story from?
I got it from the Dallas Morning News. I walked into class one day in sixth grade, and my teacher handed me a Dallas Morning News. And on the front page, above the fold, was my father behind bars. It said, and a big headline across the top, "Once the pride of Texas, South Oak Cliff star saw life sacked by drugs." And nobody had told me this was going to be in the paper. I mean, it was like one of the most embarrassing things ever. So I got it in a very public way, just as everybody else got it, actually. And that story held for a long time. And then I started writing this book, and I found that that year that he won Orange Bowl MVP, he had broken his back earlier in the season against Purdue. And later in the year, Woody wanted him to come back, and he wanted to come back. I mean, he was 20 years old.
Right.
This was his identity. And so he tries to come back, and before the game, a guy approaches him with an envelope, and he says, "You want me to give you something or make you play like a champion today?" And inside was cocaine. And he took it, and he had the game of his life, and he never played another game without it, and things spiraled from there. So much of what I'm trying to do with this book, whether it's looking at somebody like my father or looking politically at somebody like George Bush or Barack Obama, whoever it is trouble this villain-hero narrative, and to show that there's much more complexity in it, and to show that we are all happened to and happening on other people. And I had to do the hard work of seeing my father in that light before I could see anything else.
As unreliable as your parents were when you were growing up, you did have constants in your life. You had people who were there for you. Your big sister was one of those people. Tell me about her.
Oh, she was great. One of the most important parts of this book, I mean, there's a lot of darkness in the book, just because there's hopefully some honest truth about life in the book. But as I was reminded the other day, that great Leonard Cohen line, the cracks are how the light get in. There's also a lot of joy. And I think one of the most joyful parts of this book is when my sister and I, as teenagers, was sort of, you know, orphans move in together and become like the boxcar children on, you know, welfare checks and Section 8 housing. And we decide to buy a real Christmas tree because that's what people on television did. And we make up our own rules, like you can pour as much sugar as you want to in the Kool-Aid and you can run the air conditioner. We ran the air conditioner so cold that it froze, the pipes froze, and it was few ice all over the floor. And we just laughed and laughed, and we said, we're never going to be hot unless we want to. You know, and I say, you know, I'm not sure that a 19-year-old girl and a 15-year-old boy in the history of America ever had more fun making home up from scratch. And I thought it was so important, if I was going to tell the truth about life in this country, that I could show both how poor people, how people of color, how, you know, queer people are living under really hard circumstances, but I could also show how they find joy. I think of that great Lucille Clifton poem, Good Times. And the first line just says, my daddy has paid the rent. And that's it. Not some big, you know, carnival, man. It's this very quotidian piece of joy. My mama has made bread. People are singing in the kitchen. And that's what I wanted to capture in the book, to hopefully give people some sense, not just of the darkness, but of the light that comes through the cracks.
In finding your path forward, in trying to put your world in order and make things right, you pushed yourself really hard, both as a student and on the football field. With football, was there a pressure of expectation because of your dad?
For a long time, yes. I write in the book that great man is an inconvenience as a father. Because every boy wants to be a man, his own man, until it happens, you see. As if my father was the greatest man that I had ever known, and his father, who was a very prominent minister, was the greatest man that he had ever known, and that was most likely the root of all the evil inside each of us. Yeah.
Did you love playing football?
I came to love it. You know, the football material in this book works on a few levels. First is this kind of, there is this structure and this system of college and high school football that is very troubling in terms of the toll that it takes on young people, physically, emotionally, mentally. And I wanted to capture that. I saw that the most popular sport in the state of Iowa is now bowling.
Well, it's the
fastest growing. Yep. There we go. I was like, not popular. Yeah, the fastest growing sport is bowling. I said, well, you know, I think football might have seen its day gone by. So it does capture that. But also I wanted to capture these very basic moments of transcendence. You know, I never read a sports book that I could think of that was written by somebody who actually played the sport and was right in the middle of that human experience. So I wanted to capture that because and even on this book tour, every time I show up somewhere, I look out and I see one of my teammates and I'm just reminded that this is my family and it's beautiful.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Casey Gerald today. He is the author of There Will Be No Miracles Here. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Casey Gerald. He has just published his memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. And he has a remarkable life story. He grew up in dysfunction and in poverty in Dallas, Texas. He excelled in school and on the football field. That took him to Yale University on a scholarship. Later, he went to Harvard Business School. He's one of the founders of MBAs across America. And he has written about his life in part to poke holes in the narrative that we want to assign to him because of this amazing journey that he's taken. And Casey, I would love for you to read a little bit from There Will Be No Miracles Here. This is from National Signing Day. This is the moment when your future was decided as a football player and as a scholar in Texas. Can you read for us?
Sure. From the ceremony at South Oak Cliff, Tasha and I, along with the other half dozen boys in my class who were signing with the colleges that day, caravanned out to the field house at the ever-faithful Sprague Stadium for a grand event to honor boys and girls from every high school in Dallas who were putting their city on the national stage yet again as a go-to destination for any college coach who wanted to win. The bleachers overflowed with pom-poms and cowbells and posters, with peoples whose shouts gathered, swelled, and rang down at last, just as their baby's name was called by the announcer. From Skyline High School, headed to the University of Oklahoma, Charles Hunter. The bleachers rocked, or at least the section of bleachers where this boy's family stood, and he was escorted by a loved one down a long strip of red carpet in the center of the basketball court, walking slowly enough to drink up the adulation and to give the cameraman time to walk backward in front of him, recording his procession for the evening news. Perhaps by design, I was one of the last boys called. After the silence that followed the announcer booming my high school and the gasp that followed his boom of my soon-to-be college, there was a wail that ripped through the field house once he boomed my name. This was the gust of my people, strong enough to make Kimball Knights and Lincoln Tigers cheer for a South Oak Cliff Golden Bear, strong enough for the feet to stomp in the bleachers with more passion for a boy going to play for a team nobody knew existed than all the boys going off to be Longhorns or Sooners or someday even Dallas Cowboys. Strong enough for the Sprague groundskeeper to call me over to his cart once the ceremony was over. He started to speak, then caught his bottom lip with his top teeth. He rested his worn hands on my shoulders. Tears rolled down his tired cheeks. "Go all the way, son. Go all the way." I was not sure how to get to all the way, but I felt in the hands of the men and heard in the voices of the women and saw in the eyes of the little children that if I went all the way, then they would go too. And it seemed that they had been waiting so long to go. So mixed in with and likely holding together the standard reasons of going to the best college I could find and joining the best football team that would take me and living just a little over an hour from what they called the best city in the world, my going too was simply tracing those men's hands and those women's voices, and those little children's eyes, even if they pointed to a place at the eastern end of the world that I was too dim to have great passion for.
As I said earlier, a lot of people have called you the personification of the American dream, and there it is in that moment. So many people were so thrilled for you, for what you had accomplished and what your future held. How did that feel to be the person that so many people had focused these hopes and dreams on?
At the time, it felt wonderful. You know, I say, and it's true, that I had paid my dues on the outskirts of the world. I'd worn the two little pants and the worn-down shoes. I'd been a nobody to so many for so long. You know, I could still hear the "no, you take him's" and the "he's not my responsibilities," could still taste other people's leftovers. This was the first time that I felt that I really mattered to people. And that was the beginning of the trap, you see. I write in the book about a meeting I had with George Bush, which I won't get into, but it was very strange. And he started telling my story to people. And you're sort of this idea that, oh, this kid is the embodiment of the American dream. And I
right,
say that,
you're like a myth.
Absolutely. And it took me a long time to realize that rather than smiling and saying thank you, I should have wept. I am the embodiment of the American dream. The problem is that the American dream is a fantasy. It is a myth. It is this notion that stories like mine, you take a kid like me from a forgotten world like Oak Cliff, you send him off to Yale and Harvard and all these places, and it distracts us from the American machine, which is what I'm really trying to get us to pay attention to in this book. Not let go of the American dream, but hold on to something new, which is the American machine, this conveyor belt that leads most young people in this country from neighborhoods like mine, not just poor black people, poor white people, poor Latina people all over the place, from nothing to nowhere while picking off the chosen few, you see. So what I'm trying to do with this book is to help us to see that one Casey Gerald is not enough to justify the suffering of children that is guaranteed in this country in so many places. And those are choices that we have made and choices that we can make differently.
We need a better dream.
We need a better reality. Yeah. I love dreams. You know, I'm a big, you know, the title of this book is There Will Be No Miracles Here, but this is a very pro-miracle book. I believe in magic. I believe in, you know, unicorns. I mean, I'm all for it. Life is too nasty to let go of the dreams. So let's keep doing that. But let's look at the reality that 13 million children go to sleep hungry, that one in every 30 kids doesn't have a place to go to sleep stable every night, you see, that kids in my neighborhood are expected to make $21,000 a year, less than their parents were expected to make. Again, that American reality, I have tried to take my personal feelings out of the way and tell you how the country actually works, because I'm kind of like Forrest Gump. You know, I've just been a lot of places. You know, I was on Wall Street, and I was at Lehman Brothers in 2008. I was in D.C. in the early years of the Obama administration. You know, I've sat with the Black Panther that went to jail for killing Alex Rackley. I was at George Bush's dinner table. I've just been a lot of places. I spent 3 years driving 40,000 miles across the country to Appalachia, Montana, Detroit, New Orleans. I've just seen America from the very bottom and to the very top. And what this book is not some propaganda piece telling you to be a socialist. It's just saying, hey, here's how the country actually works. And if we want a better one, we can make some different choices.
We get to see Yale University through your eyes. Hmm. So before you were offered a scholarship to Yale, you hadn't heard of Yale.
I'd heard of it. Oh, I hadn't watched the Gilmore Girls, but I understood that there was a character on the Gilmore Girls
that
who went to a school named Yale.
Okay. All right. So, big background. So you get to Yale University, and just describing the social strata that is there, you were placed in a world that really you didn't know existed before you got there. And the focus, as you were inducted into Yale life, was on networking, making sure that you connected with people. But you had a really hard time connecting with people at Yale. Why was that so hard? Describe for me sort of this gulf between Casey Gerald and the people who had been expecting to go to Yale all of their lives.
I love this word, inducted. I just wrote that. I'm going to start using that. I really, really like that. I'll give you an example. My first year, I had an academic advisor who I probably wouldn't have graduated without her. But my first year, I went into a meeting and I had on a fitted hat. It's one of those Yankees caps. And she says, Casey, do you wear those around campus? And I said, yeah. She said, oh, no. It's so stereotypical. You're at Yale now. You don't have to do that anymore. And that really encapsulates what this induction was like for me and what induction is like for so many young people. We're told, I was just with these beautiful young people from University of Iowa last night, changed my life. We are told that, hey, we'll give you the keys to the kingdom. We'll give you the right jobs. We'll let you in the right schools. We'll invite you to the right parties. We'll, you know, let you in the right heaven so you can, you know, worship the right God. But yet the bargain is you have to leave a little bit of yourself outside. And you end up cutting off pieces and pieces and pieces of yourself, mutilating yourself, becoming a stranger to yourself so you can be acceptable to other people. And that is, without question, a dead end. It's a dead end. And as much as I am trying to show that I'm a glitch in the American machine, I'm also trying to account for the cost that my fellow glitches and I pay for this journey. Not long after I started this book, one of my closest friends from Yale, and I had helped recruit him. He was a kid who had a similar Horatio Alger story from St. Louis. Not long after I started this book, he committed suicide.
Your friend Elijah.
My friend Elijah. And he came to me in a dream. And he was sitting in a booth in a diner. And he said, you know, Casey, we did a lot of things that we wouldn't advise anybody we loved to do. And then I woke up, and I knew exactly what he meant. I knew that if you look at it from the right angle, a kid picking themselves up by the bootstraps looks like a suicide. And I had to confess. This is why being with those
because
young people.
He's leaving himself, his authentic self behind.
Exactly. There is no thing. The poet David White, great Irish poet, he says, you must learn one thing. This world was made to be free in. Anything or anyone who does not bring you alive is too small for you. And we've been given all these gold stars in exchange for our lives. And what I'm trying to say, because I learned it myself, is that that exchange is not worth it.
I'm talking with Casey Gerald. He's the author of There Will Be No Miracles Here. It's a memoir of his life. And Casey, you write about the code switching that you had to do. You had to learn to speak differently. And then when you learned to speak differently, you went home and people made fun of you because you spoke differently. But while you're going through all of this and writing through all of this, you have, in addition to this transition that is so difficult, you are also keeping a very important part of you a secret because you are gay, mm-hmm. and that was not something that you felt comfortable sharing with others. When you were growing up, did you know anyone who was gay? Did you have any role models? Was there an example that you could follow?
No. And I think more important than not being able to share was not being able to accept for myself, you see. What I've tried to do with this book is really not sort of write an abstract sociological study of what it means to be an oppressed gay person in America, you see. What I wanted to do is bring worthy language to the beauty and challenge of loving another boy, in my case. It's a challenge in part because we live in a society that hates gay people and teaches us to hate ourselves. When I was 7, my uncle died of AIDS. And to see that, and I had no concept of sexuality at that point, to see how he was discarded and how so many people at that time were discarded, to see all the hate, you know.
And the shame was
very traumatized. So that is part of it. You have to understand that this beauty and challenge in that context, that societal context. But it was also a challenge. Because I was for a long time a coward. That great Clarice Lispector line, the Brazilian novelist, she says, he was not innocent in the least, though he was a general victim of the world. You know, that's me. So I let so many things become excuses for not taking a risk to love somebody. And you can't love anybody unless you have this sort of basic muscle of courage. And so what the book really is, it's not necessarily about sexuality per se. I never had any question about what kind of sex I wanted, you see. It's about this journey and having enough courage to live despite all of the barriers to that living. So I'm not going to say, oh, well, you know, he couldn't accept himself because he was a football player. It's like, no, you can do whatever you choose to do. The question is, are you willing to pay the cost? And paying the cost takes a hell of a lot of courage for certain people. And it just took some time to build that kind of courage. And I think as I meet more young people, that's what they're really concerned about, their intimate human experience, not some huge abstract dissertation on, you know, how the world works.
I think one of the most poignant moments in the book is when you go to visit a boyfriend that you couldn't tell anybody about, and you go shopping for a new pair of jeans because your jeans are too baggy. Your jeans are too big. You are trying to shed your stereotypical outer mm-hmm. clothing. But it's just such a heart-wrenching moment as we see you trying to become the man that everybody wanted you to be.
It's also a very funny scene because what I say, and the jeans were still way too big for me, and I say, River, these jeans make me look gay, which is just the most absurd thing in the world. Yeah, I was 20, he was 23. And he said, and it's so funny, he says, he laughs, he says, Yeah, but they're on sale. Get them. And, you know, this is the we are such complex people, you see. And I think what literature has to do is allow for all of that messiness of our humanity to show up on the page, not to make some sort of perfect victim people or some really evil, you know, nasty villains, but to say, here are these two boys who are trying to love each other, one of whom is trying to change to fit in at this school, both of whom are trying not to be too gay, and more importantly, both of whom are trying to save some money. And I just thought, you know, that's the reality, man. You know, that's life. And I thought that was really cute.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Casey Gerald. He is the author of There Will Be No Miracles Here. It is a memoir, and he was in Iowa City, is in Iowa City right now. He spoke as part of the Green Room last night. It's a University of Iowa honors course that has opened its doors and invited the city to school. This was the final event for the Green Room for 2018. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Casey Gerald. He is the author of the new memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here. He grew up in poverty. He was a great student. He excelled on the football field. He went to Yale on scholarship and played football there, and then later went to Harvard Business School. He's one of the founders of MBAs across America. And this hour, we're talking about his story and about the America that he wants people to understand and be able to see. And Casey, you write in the book about Yale, you write that a quarter of everyone who goes to Yale wants to be president. And for the kids who come from Africa, that's a real possibility that they can go back and, sure, and possibly become president. But you were no exception. You also, a Yale student, you wanted to be president. What kind of future did you see for yourself as you were learning to be a leader at Yale?
Yeah, I thought it was a great idea to go off and run the country, you know. But there are a couple things there. First is just this book actually does benefit from all that time I spent planning to be president. You know, my agent sent it to a friend of hers who's a British actor in London, and he read it and he said, you know, when I was reading this book, I didn't feel like I was reading a memoir. I felt like I was reading a history of America. You know, I spent all this time actually trying to understand, who are these people I'm supposed to be leading? You know, these 300 million strange people all over the place. Mm-hmm. And how does this country work that I'm supposed to be in charge of at some point, you know? I have no interest in a political career now, but all of that information is embedded in the book, and I try to bring it to bear. But the deeper thing, and this goes to a conversation I was having with the young people at Iowa, University of Iowa last night, the muscle that you build as an orphan, I say, is sort of the muscle of a whore. You very quickly learn to do and say and be whatever it is you need to do and say to be to get what you need, whether it's some food or a place to sleep, whatever. This also happens to be the muscle of the politician, right? How do I very quickly get people what they need so they vote for me or whatever? The only problem is that, though that may get you very far, it's a dead end. And I try to point out how it's a dead end here. And so
I think we've watched that play out
exactly,
again and again.
Exactly. And so at base, it's not you know, hey, politics don't matter. Political action clearly matters. But I think the big question for us now is, how do we engage in politics without being politicians? Yeah. How do we engage in the business of government, whether it's the Iowa City City Council or the White House? How do we engage in the business of trying to solve big problems while bringing our full selves to that thing, not the sort of political selves that we've been seeing all these sham folks, you know, enact on cable news for years and years, not on public radio, of course.
Right. So you and your friends at Harvard had a brilliant idea. I mentioned you're one of the founders of MBAs Across America, and you and your friends took off on a road trip across the United States and learned about the United States and decided to invest your knowledge that you gained as Harvard business students in helping make businesses succeed. And it took off kind of like wildfire, a really brilliant experiment, or a brilliant maybe not an experiment, just a great action that connected with a lot of people and changed a lot of lives. But you had an experience that made you decide that that's not enough and not where you want to put your energy. Tell me about that experience.
Well, in some ways, I say that MBAs Across America radicalized me. We started just with a very simple idea. You know, what if we just drove around the country and saw what was happening? You know, and saw if we could use our skills to make a difference. And just to give you a sense of who this was, it was me, a black guy from Texas. There was a white guy from Maryland, a Jewish girl from New Mexico, and an Arab guy from Morocco. And here we are in these cars driving into, you know, White Sulphur Springs, Montana, a town of 900 people. And what this journey showed us is that there were extraordinary people across the country. I mean, this goes to the question of the American machine, right? There were extraordinary people across the country. The entrepreneur Sebastian Jackson, we worked with in Detroit, who ran a barbershop. And we show up, and we don't know anything about barbershops, but we say, hey, man, we'll help you out for a week. We did that. We did very simple things. He calls us and says, when you got here, I was on track to do $6,000 of revenue a month. Now I'm on track to do $18,000 of revenue a month. I've raised $100,000 from a local investor because she helped me articulate my business plan. What that taught us was that there were extraordinary people across the country doing extraordinary things, and all they needed was a little wind at their back. Well, it just so happened all the whim was captured by my friends and classmates at Harvard Business School and by my friends and classmates at Yale, that the structural reality of the country, and I saw this over and over again as we were out there on the road, was that Sebastian was structurally set up to fail. And Sarah Calhoun, the great entrepreneur we worked with in White Sulphur Springs, Montana, or Jack and Corey in Little Rock, Arkansas, who ran the Root Cafe, they were set up to not get that bank loan, to not have access to capital and employees, et cetera, et cetera. My friends at Harvard Business School were set up to have direct access to the Federal Reserve, you see.
Right.
So if we actually want a country where everybody's got a shot, I mean everybody, then we have to look at the fact that Sebastian Jackson can't get $50,000 of money for his barbershop, but my friend at Harvard Business School can get $50 million for, a toaster oven that's going to be a robot. I mean, you know, that to me is something that we can do pretty easily, very differently.
And that sounds like purpose. That sounds like you found your place. You were out there changing lives dramatically, but then you decided it wasn't enough. Why not?
It really boiled down to sort of a couple-day span of time I had toward the third year. I had spent an evening at a gala in New York for alumni of Harvard Business School, you know, a couple hundred people, Michael Bloomberg, all these billionaire folks, you know. And everybody was getting awards for all the great deeds they had done, you know. And maybe they should have. In the room, they probably had between net worth and assets under management about $250 billion or something. And, I left. And it was fine. And then a couple of days later, I went up the road to Harlem. And I was working with an entrepreneur, Tony Hilliard, from Harlem Grown. It was an urban farming company that doubled as youth development. And he's telling me about this program, all these kids below the poverty line, many of them homeless, many of them getting the only meal they got each day from his program. And I said, Tony, this sounds fantastic. Why are you not doing more of it? And he said, well, listen, I just don't have any money. I was a cab driver for 20 years. I retired. I started this program. And I don't take a salary because Harlem Grown needs the money. And I left and I said, wait a second. How is it that I live in a country, in a city at a time, where I can spend one night in one room where a couple hundred people have $500 billion. And 2 days later, I can go 50 blocks away and be with a man who's going without a salary so that an 8-year-old girl can get her only meal of the day. If, and this may be heretical, if Donald Trump got one thing right, I don't think I've ever planned to say that. It is that the system is rigged. And it's rigged for people like him, of course. But it's also rigged against people like Tony Hilliard. And what I found was that I was being used, just as I say, to distract us from the reality. And so what we did, we put this organization out of business, and we say it's not enough for one small nonprofit to do this work. Harvard Business School needs to do this work that has $3 billion and is educating 1,800 people a year and is 110 years old. This ought to be at the very core. We can't just have topical solutions. We got to get it down in the very dirt. I was listening to the CEO of General Mills the other day, and he said, I'm in the dirt business. You know, and if the dirt's good, everything we grow will be good. So I felt that we had to fix the dirt of our institutions and of our country, not just have one good tree of MBAs across America that was growing in toxic soil. So we built a curriculum that's now actually the most popular course, elective course at Harvard Business School. And hopefully, you know, and things like the Green Room inspire me. Hopefully that'll spread to change the way we educate people and also change the political choices that we make in terms of who gets some support and resources and who doesn't.
I'm talking with Casey Gerald. His memoir is There Will Be No Miracles Here. So you came to speak to the Green Room. It's an honor seminar, and the students at the Green Room ask some of the big questions about purpose and meaning, and the focus this time around was reimagining education. And one of the things that you did, you gave everybody homework before they came. You asked them, what would you do if you weren't afraid? Why do you think that's such an important question?
The first time I asked that was to a group of 16, 22-year-olds. And I found that there were kind of three camps. The first was the camp of the sort of jerk kid who's like, hey, fear is a good thing, man. I hate this question. I reject the premise of the question. It's always that annoying little kid, you know. The second camp were probably the heart of the bell curve were kids who said, you know, if I weren't afraid, I'd go bungee jumping or I'd go on a safari, et cetera, whatever. And then something strange happened. This kid couldn't even get his answer out. He started crying. I'm like, what's happening, man? He said, if I wasn't afraid, I'd stop making crap art. Because every time I go to make a play, every time I stand on stage, I'm just paralyzed by what people are going to think about me. And another girl, she starts crying. She says, if I wasn't afraid, I'd go home and I'd come out to my parents. And what I realized was that so many of us are paralyzed, are haunted by these things that are eating away at us, that if we did them, might just set us free. And might just allow us to live a little bigger in the world. And I was reminded last night of a conversation I had recently with a junior in college. And he said, do you have any advice for us? And I said, well, what's on your mind? And he said, well, I think a lot of us are wondering whether we can be all of who we are and still be successful. And that question just took me out. And so I thought about it. And I said, well, John, the question is not, can you be all of who you are and still be successful? The question is, if you are not all of who you are, then what good is success? And so why this question of what would you do if you weren't afraid is so important is because the less you think about it, the more honest you'll be. And what you'll realize is that you've made these small concessions for success, for acceptance. And the concessions are little pieces of yourself, as I always say. And all you have to say is, you know, is let's bring all of us together, all of myself together. You know, I have a line in the book, I've been so many things along my curious journey. And the challenge is not to put all those little things in different boxes and store them in a nice file folder. The challenge is to bring all of that mess, all of that strange, raw magic, and say, that's all of me. And if you can't take all of me, you can't have none. And I try to do that as well with the language in this book.
You do such a beautiful job really illustrating this gulf between where you grew up in Texas and Yale University. And there's an empathy gap that is so huge. I mean, the students that you were interacting with at Yale University could not imagine the world that you grew up in. There's nothing in their personal experience that would help them understand this other world that they've only heard of. Mm-hmm. How do we bridge that empathy gap? I mean, that's the biggest problem, in my view, that we have in the United States, is this empathy gap. We can't understand each other.
Yeah. What's great or encouraging to me is that it's not complicated, but it's damn hard. Yeah. I was telling a young person that I said the only reasonable response of the young people on America's college campuses is total rebellion. Yeah. You got to get out of the classroom, man. You got to get out of the cubicle. You got to cross the road and go talk to somebody. We were these four people in White Sulphur Springs, Montana, and I'm walking down a dusty road. And I'm the only black guy in the town. My friend Hisham's the only Arab in the town, perhaps the only Arab in the history of White Sulphur Springs, Montana. I'm walking down this dusty road on a hot afternoon, and I hear a man yelling from across the street, "Turn around!" And I'm like, oh my God, what's about to happen? This old, weather-beaten white rancher outside of a beat-up pickup truck. And I didn't turn around, I just kept walking. He says, "Turn around!" So now my heart's beating fast. I'm like, this is it, you know. And just as I turn, I kind of wander in the road, and there's a car coming. I say, oh God, either I'm going to get hit by the car or I'm going to cross the road. So I cross the road, and I go toward the man. My heart's beating fast. And he says, "Where'd you get your shirt?" And I say, oh God, this man thought I stole my shirt. What's happening? So I start dropping all these names. Oh, sir, where was Sarah Calhoun, blah, blah, blah. And this is shortly after Trayvon Martin was murdered. And I tell him, and he says, "Oh, cool, man. I just want to know because I want one too." Turns out, he says, "I'm Wes. I'm the town mechanic." So we wound up sitting on the side of this road talking, this me and this old white rancher. And at the end, I tell him we're going to Las Vegas next to continue our journey. And he says, "Well, here." He reaches in his pocket and gives me $2 worth of quarters for the slot machines. He said, "If you win any money, come back and see me." You see, this is we have to. This is, again, why this question, what would you do if you weren't afraid, is so important. It actually is not hard to go to the other side of Iowa City or to go to the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans or to go down to Pikeville, Kentucky, where 10,000 coal miners have lost. It's not hard. It's not complicated, but it's hard. And when we are willing to do that work, then we will see, as Maya Angelou used to always say, we are more alike than we are unalike. And then we'll be able to finally, perhaps, really achieve the vision of America, which can't happen unless we see that we're all in this together.
You told me that last night was a life-changing night for you, talking to these students at the University of Iowa. What do you take away from the experience?
What I take away from that experience is that we are in the early days of a beautiful and dangerous revolution when it comes to the terms by which we live in the world, and it's starting on the inside. These young people are not given any quarter to the ideas about life that were handed to them. They know something's up, and they're looking for something new, and I love that.
Casey Gerald, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Casey Gerald, his new memoir is called There Will Be No Miracles Here. It tells about his life as he grew up in poverty in Dallas, Texas, and went to Yale on scholarship, played football at Yale, later to Harvard Business School. He's one of the founders of MBAs across America. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @Iowa Public Radio or also on Facebook. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.